everybody, and welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. On December 27, 2004, a delegation departed from the U.S., bound for the Iraq-Jordanian border, and carrying $650,000 of humanitarian aid for the people of Fallujah. The 11-member delegation consisted of several parents who had lost loved ones in Operation Freedom and the World Trade Center bombing: Amalia Avila, Nadia McCaffrey, Fernando and Rosa Suarez del Solar, and Adele Welty. Accompanying them were four members of Code Pink, the Women's Peace Movement: Medea Benjamin, Aria Shell, Jody Evans, and Gail Murphy. Henry Khalil, the organizing coordinator of United for Peace and Justice; Vivian Fayer, a psychologist and educator specializing in bereavement; and Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman, the chief of cardiology of Kaiser Richmond, made up the rest of the group. On February 8, 2005, the delegation presented the story of their week-long journey at New College in San Francisco, California. They talked about what they delivered, where they got it, how they delivered it, the group of Iraqi doctors they delivered it to, and how they and the Iraqis felt about the war. Sharing their grief forged personal connections, and this heart-to-heart communication made Families for Peace more than just another group delivering yet another batch of American aid to a country war-torn by American bombs. As I listened to their story, it became clear to me that the Americans and the Iraqis had made an heroic beginning toward healing the emotional and physical wounds of Operation Freedom. Feelings of brotherhood were born, and these feelings are a vital step toward peace in the Middle East. They were born in a climate of extreme danger to all involved. What follows is part two of Families for Peace: What's Really Happening in Iraq. In it, you will hear from Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman. Also, Medea Benjamin talks about Code Pink's plans for civil disobedience on March 19th, and there is a short question and answer session.
So we're going to hear now from Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman, who is a cardiologist at Kaiser Permanente. It was really wonderful having Jeffrey on the trip because we had a group of doctors who came to be with us. And we set up a pretty amazing team that continues to receive humanitarian aid that we continue to send. We just sent another installment last week. We are getting constant reports about how the money is being spent and reports about conditions in the refugee camps and the ongoing need there. Jeff Ritterman.
I'm Jeff Ritterman. I'm a cardiologist at Kaiser in Richmond, and I went on the delegation representing Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm going to talk a little bit about the experience of the delegation, a little bit about the health consequences, just to try to paint a human, put a human face on the war and the statistics. The first reason we're all here, I just want to share a quote that I came upon from Lieutenant Colonel Richard Long, speaking at the Media at War conference. This is what he said: "Frankly, our job is to win the war. Part of that is information warfare. So we are going to attempt to dominate the information environment." So that's why we're here, right? Because the information environment is being dominated, and the spin is now that everybody's happy in Iraq, they had democratic elections, and they have us to thank, and all of our people are acting honorably there. And so the whole reality of what's going on has been, you know, whitewashed, and here we are. So we have to share these stories, and we need to be in your schools and your workplaces and in your homes and in your churches and your temples and wherever. So after, you know, come up and ask us, because the whole thing we have to do is we have to build a peace movement that can begin to tip the scales in favor of withdrawal. part of understanding Iraq now is understanding what Iraq was like before. And Iraq was a pretty well-off country before 1990. Here's a quote I had from UNICEF. Before 1990 and the imposition of sanctions, Iraq had one of the highest standards of living in the Middle East. So a person, a 25-year-old person in Iraq now has lived through three wars and a dozen years of sanctions. Now, you'll remember that the reason that we pushed the sanctions in the UN, the reason that we pushed the sanctions, our reasoning was they had weapons of mass destruction. So we know now that either our intelligence was really faulty or we were lied to or both. So for 12 years they had the sanctions, and 500,000 children or so died as a consequence. So they ask a Democratic administration, right? Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. So 500,000 Iraqi children have died. Do you think the sanctions are worth it? And of course she said yes, they were. And the people in Iraq hear these things. They know these things. Can you imagine one American politician ever justifying anything, world peace, anything, but saying that it was okay for 500,000 American children to die? I mean, imagine a politician being able to get up and say that. Well, now compare the populations. They've got 20-something million, we've got close to 300 million. So now you're up to 3 million American children dying, if you make it proportional. So yet our, you know, liberal side, our Democrats say that's okay. Whose children are we talking about? You talking about my child? So there's an awful lot of parents in Iraq who have lost a child who know that they lost a child because of our foreign policy. Now, one of the things I didn't know when we met with the doctors is medical information didn't get in for a dozen years. So that's part of the sanctions. So the doctors come and say, you know, we don't know what's happening in the medical world for a dozen years. Now, what kind of foreign policy is it for a country to keep the doctors in another country uninformed? How could that possibly help anything? Contrast that to Cuba sending 10,000 doctors to the countryside in Venezuela, one of the cardinal sins that we hold against the Hugo Chavez government, okay? So here these sanctions have totally weakened and decimated the country, the medical system, and then on top of that comes the war and the latest onslaught. I should just say that I don't know if you have a relationship with New College in New York, but the president of New College in New York, who used to be the senator from Nebraska and the governor of Nebraska and a Vietnam War hero, Bob Kerry, and a very likely Democratic hopeful sometime in the future, when asked the same question as Madeleine Albright, said, yes, it was worth it. I mean, we don't find the weapons of mass destruction. When you do something wrong and you hurt somebody, the thing to do is to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that we killed 500,000 of your children. We were wrong, right? Not to go bomb them, as the next thing we do. Of course, the sanctions didn't have any impact on getting Saddam Hussein out of power. They never do. The sanctions always hurt the people in the country. I don't think the sanctions, you know, are really the way to have foreign policy. And we shouldn't have sanctions against Cuba either, and that's another thing we should change. I don't know how many of you are aware of this famous cluster study that was published in The Lancet, but I spoke on a panel on Sunday at Stanford with the lead author of that study, and what they did was, right, you know, after the war was over, about October of 2004, they went in with a team and they sampled 300 Iraqi households. It turns out that if you sample 300 households in a country, you get an awful lot of information. You get about half as much information as if you sample 3,000. So you get a lot of information. And what they were able to show was that there had been 100,000 civilian deaths in the excess deaths. In other words, over and above what you'd expect. There are 100,000 excess deaths in the period of time since our invasion. That the majority of those deaths were caused by us. That the majority of deaths were violent deaths. That your chances of dying violently in Iraq in the year and a half before our invasion as compared with the year and a half after were 58 times worse. In other words, after the invasion, your chances of a violent death were 58 times greater than before. So for every person who died a violent death before the invasion, 58 died a violent death after the invasion. All-cause mortality, that's doctor talk, right? For how many people, for dying of anything, is 2.5 times greater, okay? Because people die of other things, too. So, and where those deaths come from? They come from the air war, indiscriminate air power. These very smart bombs that we're dropping, they're killing mainly civilians. I don't know how many of you have been reading Dar's information, Dar Jamal. He had a very interesting article on the air war. Here's what our people say about the air war. Air power remains the single greatest asymmetrical advantage the United States has over its foes. We must aggressively develop and employ air power's counter-guerrilla capabilities. And this is said by Thomas Searle, who's a military defense analyst with the Air Power Research Institute at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Okay, so we must aggressively develop and employ air power's counter-guerrilla capabilities. That doesn't sound so bad. Doesn't sound like it has anything to do with human beings. This is what it's like to live under the bomb. Every night we told each other goodbye because we expected to die. Every night there was extremely heavy bombing from the jets. My house shook when bombs hit the city, and the women were crying all of the time. So we stayed inside most of the time and prayed. The more the bombs exploded, the more we prayed and cried. So it's kind of different when you're under the bomb. So this is the problem. We have no empathy in this country. We are able to do these terrible things there and never put ourselves in their position. The way I understand the war is we could justify the war because we think they had weapons of mass destruction that they were maybe going to give to some other bad people who are maybe going to come over here and do something bad, just like happened on 9/11. So, as our president said, freedom from fear. So in order for us and our children not to be afraid, we go over there and destroy an entire country. Imagine what, the major population of that country is under 18. So now you have these kids growing up in two or three wars who are going to be the backbone of that country in another 20 years. What are they going to think about the United States? You feel safe because you have friends, because there are people in the world who see the world like you do, and you work together. You don't feel safe because you have your boot on their throat, because sooner or later, somebody who you have the boot on their throat is going to do something terrible in one of your cities, like happened before. Which I just want to end with telling a story that tells a little bit to me of the pain on our side. At one point, Amalia came out and said, "Today, Victor would have been 20. You know, and everybody started crying. You know, and this is the cost, a life that never got to be totally lived, and grandchildren that aren't going to be there." Another couple who came on the delegation, Fernando and Rosa, their son, Jesus, died after being there for 10 days. And so imagine that your son, your only son, has been sent into harm's way because we are saying they have weapons of mass destruction, which we don't find. Your son sees no action over there, steps on an unexploded cluster bomb. So this is an illegal bomb to use in civilian areas, which is, of course, where we drop them. 20% of them don't explode, and one took Jesus's life. So your son, who persuaded your family to move from Tijuana in his last year of high school so he could join the Marines, he loses his life in this way. So this is the tragedy of it. And these are the stories that we have to tell so that it's not the sanitized view. It's not that this is a clean war, that nobody's suffering and everybody's happy because there's democracy. You don't institute a peaceful democratic process in a country by killing a couple hundred thousand of its people, by destroying its entire infrastructure so that people don't have clean water, don't have electricity. They're sitting on a sea of oil, and you have to wait 2 days for gas. There's 60% unemployment. There's no army. There's no police force. A doctor my age would have left or been held ransom, you know, and that's why so many of them did leave. So our job, and I look at the world through the medical lens, so what's the prevention here? The prevention is to get out. To get us out of there as soon as we can, and not only the Army, not only the Marines, but the corporations. Because it's a crime for a corporation to be benefiting from this foreign policy. So I invite you to ask us to come to your home, your workplace. I will have the computer working next time. I want to say, that it was really an honor to be on the delegation. I was so impressed with the organizing that Medea and the others did we got in there at maybe 9 at night, and there was people waiting for us at a meeting. You know, it was no going to your room. Never mind that we didn't have, our luggage had been lost. There was, you know, and that's how it was, you know, every moment was full and meaningful, and there were a lot of tears all the time. And so we have this inside us now. So we have to share this so that you can have some of it inside of you and that you can share it, because that's how we build it. You know, Vietnam, 2 million maybe Vietnamese had to die. 56,000 guys my age died. Another 50,000 came back and killed themselves. When you drive here, you definitely passed a Vietnam veteran homeless on the street. These kids who are torturing people in Abu Ghraib, we're going to ask them to run the Little League, to go to the PTA meetings. It's going to be very difficult for these people. So, and I just want to also recognize, because I got asked to speak, but really I did part of this as a partnership, as a team with my partner Vivian.
We'd like to open it up now to your questions. And there already was a question about napalm that maybe Arya could answer.
I can just answer what I know, and is that Dar has interviewed many, many, many refugees from Fallujah and has heard the same story coming out again and again about these mushroom clouds, about the kind of fires that the bodies, that the water couldn't put out, which is... often what happens with napalm or phosphorus weapons. Also, very strangely, Rana, who's been going into Fallujah on a regular basis to bring the medical supplies in, she reported that there have been, the military has been using bulldozers and taking out big chunks of soil and carting it away, and using water hoses to spray down the streets. I heard a report of even some of the water tanks that exist that being shot into so that there can be no washing away the evidence and the traces. And that for people to enter also, to come in and out of Fallujah, they're using ID cards and also retina scans. It's very Orwellian. Also, it's very difficult for people to get in or out of Fallujah. But on Dar's website, if people haven't gone there, it's darjamailiraq.com. He has all of these photographs, like a few that I showed, where the skin is melted and burned in ways that can only have been done by the use of chemical and phosphorus weapons. So, and there's more and more evidence coming out. There's footage, and there's war tribunals happening around the world about the use of the war crimes that we're committing using chemical weapons, the cluster bombs, the depleted uranium. So,
question two concerns whether the term genocide is applicable to the war in Iraq, especially because the U.S. is using depleted uranium as vehicle armor.
The question is anyone using the term genocide, and do the U.S. soldiers know about depleted uranium? No one's calling it genocide, and genocide actually has a sort of specific definition. I don't know it, but in international, law, there's a definition. I don't think anyone's used that term to my knowledge.
I've heard a couple of the Iraqis that I spoke with, both Rana and Iman, who were on the delegation, have said that it's very much like genocide in terms of what's happening in Fallujah. She's described it as a concentration camp with the razor wire, the piles of bodies in the streets, the mass graves, on and on. So it has been likened to that. I don't know officially where that, when it becomes genocide, but basically.
It's a good question, though. And the depleted uranium, I don't really know. I think his name is Colonel Rocky. I don't know if any of you have heard him on the radio. He was the person who was in charge of cleaning up the depleted uranium from the Gulf War. And he told me that there are 300,000 people from the Gulf War with sickness that are now on disability. And he attributes most of it to DU. But there's the depleted uranium. Within the depleted uranium discussion, there are some people who are claiming everything is from it, and others who are feeling like they should be much more cautious. It's very difficult. When we were in Amman, two families approached us with kids with leukemia, Iraqi families. One needed a bone marrow transplant. One needed chemotherapy. I think we were able to help just these two, and both families believed that it was from unconventional weapons, whether it was depleted uranium or not. But most of the nuclear stuff was destroyed, and most of the chemical stuff was destroyed in the Gulf War. How was it destroyed? It was bombed indiscriminately. It was like you took, I think it was Colonel Rocky said that, it was like an ice cube, and you hit it with a sledgehammer. That stuff is everywhere. So how does, I have pictures in here of the nine kids without eyes. Now, how do you know if it's depleted uranium or something from the nuclear stuff that was bombed or something from chemical or something somewhere else? It's, difficult to do. There's a New York Times reporter who's going to hopefully do something for us.
Question three was, how did you get the materials into Iraq? How did you deliver them to the city of Fallujah? Medea will answer this question.
I mean, it was all, in the beginning, very complicated to figure out for a number of reasons. Aria talked about how dangerous the road is from Baghdad to the border of Jordan, and we were worried about taking the supplies in physically because we thought either they would get confiscated at the border, they might get confiscated by the Iraqi National Guard, they might get confiscated by the U.S. military that didn't want them going to the refugees, they might get stolen by looters who just roam the roads and oftentimes just stop cars and steal whatever they can. So we were concerned about it sending a lot of this overland. We sent some of it overland, and thank goodness we got all of that through. But we decided that whatever could be bought in Iraq, we would actually buy it inside Iraq. So we have a system now where we send money to a delegation that's been set up of doctors, a pharmacist, a humanitarian aid worker, They let us know as soon as they receive the money we sent. They go and do the purchases, and a lot of the purchases you can get inside Iraq, whether it's some medicines, and many of the things we've been buying have also been blankets, clothing for the children, heaters for the refugees living in very cold tents. Then they send us the receipts for these, and as soon as we see the receipts for them, we send another installment. So that's the way it's been working, partially sending things overland, partially also sending things by plane. There is a plane service that is also very risky because the planes landing in Baghdad, oftentimes the airport is closed in Baghdad. It's a very dangerous flight to go in. And then the road from the airport into town is very dangerous. So we've been doing, you know, a little bit through air, a little by ship, and a little of it buying within Iraq.
Question 4 asks whether the group met any political opposition to their plans from anybody, especially within the United States.
Well, I have been quite amazed that so far we have not. And I don't know if that's because it's being done sort of under the radar screen. I don't know if it's because, I tend to think it's because the government of the U.S. knows about it, but knows that we have tremendous support. And we not only have large grassroots support, we've also looked to individuals that are well known both in the Hollywood circles and others like that who have given us donations. And we kind of tried to protect ourselves by getting lots of people of both fame as well as lots of grassroots supporters. And perhaps so far that's what has protected us. Well, in terms of the rage issue, you know, many of us wanted to go inside Iraq. We went there with the intention of part of the delegation being able to physically take the supplies into Iraq. And this was a very brave delegation, and really everybody wanted to go. The Iraqis who came to meet us in Jordan said, well, it's one thing for you to feel okay about risking your own life, but you'll be risking the life of every Iraqi who is with you, the driver who drives you, the translator who translates for you, the people who host you, the people who meet with you, because there is such rage against Americans right now. And I think it really is an indication of how far we have sunk in the eyes of the Iraqi people, that just a year ago when Gail and I went several times to Iraq during the U.S. occupation, we were treated just with incredible openness and hospitality and love by the Iraqi people. And now those same people who do love us and would like us to come say it's much too dangerous because there is less recognition between a, quote, good American and a bad American at this point. And so it's very, very hard for us to have the same kind of solidarity ties with the Iraqi people right now that we would like to, because it is so difficult to get inside the country. And that's why we do feel tremendous thanks for the Iraqis who took those risks to come out and spend time with us, and the Iraqis who are taking the risk to go around the world like they are. When I was in Brazil at the World Social Forum, there were quite a number of Iraqis from Fallujah, as well as Iraqis who were Shiites, who came to talk to us. And So it is dangerous for everybody right now. Did you want
to? I just wanted to add a couple of things. I traveled a little bit before the delegation and met a lot of folks. And when we would tell them we were Americans, for the most part, we got a lot of questions. And when we kind of established right off the bat what our politics were, it opened up these incredible conversations. And people were pretty shocked, actually, to hear that there's a resistance within the U.S. As much as the media censors the truth coming to the American people, it also censors, you know, that there is a movement here. But it also really brought it home to me that we need to be a lot louder, that we need to activate our movement, especially now. I just spoke with an Iraqi friend and Dar, and they're just preparing for it to get worse. It's just, at this point, there's a tremendous feeling of hopelessness, especially after the elections where they're in many ways legitimized their presence to some. So yes, the corporations, yes, to support GI resistance, and also in terms of media, we need to be the media, we need to get the information out there. So I just want to say a few things that are coming up. I mean, Jeff mentioned that we're available. I have a slide. This is actually half of the slideshow, so I'm also available to come and do presentations, and I'm also creating a theater piece, weaving the testimonies, about a 20-minute piece. So if you're interested in a more creative presentation about these stories, please speak with me.
In this next section, Medea will discuss the upcoming plans for Code Pink.
As you all well know, or you wouldn't be here, we've got a lot of work to do to end this occupation and to educate other people in this country that have now, the majority of them, are saying in the polls that they think this war was a mistake, that it's, quote, not worth fighting, but yet the majority have not made the next connection saying, and therefore we should bring the troops home. And that's our job right now. We know that here in the Bay Area, we often set the tone, a positive one, for the rest of the country. We were the ones here that passed the first end the occupation resolution here on November 2nd that passed overwhelmingly. There are efforts underway, can I even say, to make San Francisco a sanctuary city for people in the military that refuse to go back and fight. Some other things that are in the works. March 19th is the second anniversary of the invasion, and we need to make this huge, and especially here in the Bay Area, we need to make it huge. The strategy this time around is not to say everybody go to New York or everybody go to Washington, but to have hundreds of protests around the country and around the world. And I just got back from the World Social Forum in Brazil, where we had over 30 groups in 30 different countries pledge that they would be organizing protests against the invasion on the weekend of March 19th and 20th, including a group of Iraqis who said no matter what the risk was inside Iraq, they would be coming out to protest on March 19th as well. So make sure you not only come to the rally that's being organized here that will be in Dolores Park at noon, but also to get lots and lots of other people to do that. We are planning lots of other things, and when I say we, I'm speaking in the name of both Global Exchange and Code Pink and the Coalition United for Peace and Justice. One of the things we're looking at is a campaign that focuses state by state on the National Guards. You know, the National Guard was created to protect people at home from fires and tornadoes and earthquakes and other disasters of that type. And now we have 40% of the troops in Iraq are National Guard and Reserves. So we want to launch a really strong campaign where we are getting city officials and state officials to go to the governors and say, we want you to say to George Bush that we want our National Guard to be here at home protecting people, not fighting in Iraq. And as part of that, you can imagine what fun it will be to get Arnold Schwarzenegger to squirm a little bit and really try to force him to do this. There are also a lot of plans we have about trying to bring the costs of the war back home. And you know that George Bush just unveiled his budget proposal and hasn't even considered in that budget proposal the $80 billion that they're going to be requesting for more war. And meantime, have slashed budgets for education, for food stamps, for public housing, for public transportation like Amtrak. We want to make this real and take the public services in our cities that are being slashed and demand that the money be restored for those, that they be protected, and really relate it to the cost of the war with campaigns like Books Not Bombs and Healthcare Not Warfare. So all of these are important, important things, and especially important to be very, very strong here in the Bay Area. So we're going to pass around some buckets right now and ask for your financial support so we can do this work. You can make checks out, and we hope you'll be as generous as you can. You can make them out to Global Exchange, and we will use this for the very intense organizing work that we have to be doing in the coming months. So thank you for your generous financial support. Thank you for all the time and energy that all of you put into this anti-war work.
Medea goes on here to wrap up the evening.
Well, I just want to say that I think this is, first of all, the fact that this place isn't packed tells us something, that people are tired of protesting, tired of coming out, and we can't get tired. We've got so much that we have to do, and things are getting worse. They're not getting better. And so, one, we have to get our friends and relatives and neighbors enthusiastic about March 19th to get out in large numbers. And those of us here are obviously the diehards. we've got to take it to the next level. And so I really ask of you to think about doing some kind of civil disobedience. We're planning a number of things. If you are willing to do something with us, come and talk to us about it afterwards. But think of what you've done so far and take it to the next level. And let me just end by a quote that from the World Social Forum, where I was last week. And it was at a big stadium where Hugo Chavez came to speak. And Hugo Chavez is, on the hit list of Condoleezza Rice and George Bush and the rest of the folks in the administration. Why? Because he wasn't elected democratically? No, he was elected several times democratically and reaffirmed overwhelmingly in a referendum. It's because he is using the oil money to benefit the poor. And that is a bad example in the eyes of this administration. And so Hugo Chavez is a champion around the world right now of somebody who not only is standing up to the U.S. administration, is the only one I know that called George Bush a pendejo, but is really trying to model inside Venezuela the kind of redistribution of resources to help those who really need them. And he was speaking in front of this packed stadium. I mean, you couldn't get in. It was like he was a rock star. There were about 20,000 inside and more than that outside, just clamoring and fighting to get inside to hear him. And he spoke beautifully about what inspires him as a person. And he started out by saying he's inspired by an old revolutionary anti-imperialist, and that's Jesus Christ. And he went on from there, and he talked about others like Marx and Lenin and Engels, and he says, and I always used to carry around that little red book of Mao Zedong. I used to love reading that red book. And then he talked about Simón Bolívar. He talked about the indigenous people, Tupac Amaru, Atahualpa Yupanqui. He talked about all the kinds of people who have inspired him in his life. And he said that all of them were people who were for democracy, and as he talked about Jesus Christ, against empire, in that case, the Roman Empire. And he talked about how empires come and but go, and they always go. They don't last because they can't last. And he says that it's not just the oppression on the outside and the resistance on the outside. It's the oppression on the inside and the decay on the inside and the resistance on the inside. And he says he looked forward to the day when the U.S. empire would crumble, not only because it would open up the possibilities of liberation of people around the world, but it would also open up the possibilities of liberation of the people in the U.S. who he called the people of Martin Luther King. So let's go from here recognizing that we are at one with the global community, that we are working for this empire to fall so that we ourselves can live in a democracy and live at one with the people around the world. So thank you for coming. Thank you for all you do. Let's build democracy at home.
You have been listening to part two of Families for Peace, What's Really Happening in Iraq. You have heard from members of that delegation, Medea Benjamin and Ariel Schell from Code Pink, Amalia Avila, who lost her son in Iraq, and Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman, Chief of Cardiology at Kaiser Richmond in California. The Code Pink website is codepinkforpeace.org. That's Code Pink, number four, Peace, peace.org. This program is a San Francisco Liberation Radio production. The web address of San Francisco Liberation Radio, a 24/7 internet radio station, is www.liberationradio.net. Music is by Chris Potter and Late Bake Productions. Thank you for listening. This is Carmen LaSalle.